At a spiritual seance, a clairvoyant can see the etheric double oozing usually out of the left side of the medium, though sometimes from the whole surface of the body, and it is this which often appears as the materialized spirit, easily molded into various shapes by the thoughts of the sitters, and gaining strength and vitality as the medium sinks into a deep trance. Usually, of course, this takes place without any conscious effort on the part of the sitters. It may, however, be achieved deliberately. Thus, H. P. Blavatsky stated that during the remarkable phenomena at the Eddy homestead she deliberately molded the spirit form which appeared into various likenesses, these being seen by the sitters present. Although etheric matter, molded into such spirit forms, is invisible to ordinary sight, it may nevertheless be able to affect a photographic plate, the latter being sensitive to certain wavelengths of light which leave the human eye unaffected. This is the rationale of the many cases on record where spirit forms have appeared on the negative of an ordinary photographic portrait. In addition to the matter of the etheric double of the medium, it frequently happens at seances that etheric matter is withdrawn also from the bodies of the sitters, hence the lassitude frequently felt by those who attend such seances. It is only in conditions of perfect passivity that much matter can be withdrawn from the physical body without danger to life. Although the medium is usually conscious all the time in the background, yet any attempt to assert the individuality, or to think connectedly, immediately weakens the materialized form, or brings it back to the cabinet. A sudden shock or disturbance, or any attempt to seize the spirit form is apparent to be in the highest degree dangerous and may even result in death. In addition to the extrusion of etheric matter, in many cases the dense physical matter, probably chiefly gases and liquids, is also removed at the same time from the body of the medium. Many cases are on record where, during a materialization, the body of the medium shriveled perceptibly, the shrunken, wizened appearance of the face being said to be singularly ghastly and unpleasant to see. By actual weighing, the physical body of the medium has been found to be as much as 40 pounds less than normal, whilst the weight of the materialized form has been found to be at least as much as the diminution of the medium's weight, and usually more than this, presumably owing to the extraction of some dense matter from the bodies of the sitters. In one well-known case, a materialized form carried the diminished body of the medium, Mr. Eglinton, to an astral entity, who wishes to manifest himself or to produce some phenomenon on the physical plane. A medium serves the purpose of providing the necessary etheric matter, which acts as an intermediary to convey the astral forces into physical matter. A somewhat similar process takes place when a dead drunkard, hovering about a gin shop, draws round himself a veil of etheric matter, in order that he may absorb the odor of the alcohol for which he craves. Being unable to smell alcohol in the same way as we do, he tries to induce others to become drunk, so that he may be able partially to enter their physical bodies and obsess them, thus once more directly experiencing the taste and other sensations he so ardently desires. Sometimes only sufficient etheric is withdrawn from a medium to produce an etheric hand, or even just sufficient of the fingers to hold a pencil and write, or to enable raps to be made, objects to be overturned or moved, and so forth. Usually, etheric matter, as well as dense physical matter, is withdrawn from the medium and utilized so as to cover an astral shape just sufficiently to make the latter visible to the sitters, the form seen thus not being solid but merely a thin film. Spirit drapery, however, so usual at seances, is frequently made from the clothing of a medium or of a sitter. The texture may be quite coarse, or exceedingly fine, finer in fact than any product of Eastern looms. Occasionally such drapery may be removed from the seance room, sometimes lasting for years, at other times fading away in an hour or so, or even in a few minutes. There can be no question that, except possibly in very rare cases, and where every possible precaution is taken, the practice of mediumship is harmful, and may be exceedingly dangerous. Nevertheless, it must be admitted that by its means large numbers of people have acquired knowledge of, or belief in, the reality of the unseen world and of the continuance of life after death. On the other hand, It may be urged that such knowledge or such belief could have been secured in other and less harmful ways. A trained occultist, for example, connected with any school of white magic, would never interfere with the etheric double of any man in order to produce a materialization, nor would he disturb his own if he wished to make himself visible at a distance. He would simply condense and build into and around his astral body a sufficient quantity of the surrounding ether to materialize it, and hold it in that form by an effort of will as long as he needed it. Most spirit guides are well aware of the dangers to which their mediums are exposed, and take every precaution in their power to protect the mediums. Even the spirits themselves may occasionally suffer when, for example, a materialized form is struck or wounded, owing to the intimate connection established between the etheric matter of the materialized form and the astral matter of the spirit's body. It is, of course, true that no physical weapon could affect an astral body, but an injury to a materialized form may be transmitted to the astral body by the phenomenon known as repercussion. Owing to the fact that during a materialization matter may be borrowed from all the sitters present as well as from the medium, a considerable intermixture of such matter may take place, and consequently undesirable qualities or vices in any one of the sitters are liable to react upon the others and most of all upon the medium, who is most drawn upon and is almost certainly the most sensitive person present. Nicotine and alcohol poisoning appear to be especially liable to produce unpleasant effects in this manner. Mediums of low type inevitably attract eminently undesirable astral entities, who may reinforce their own vitality at the expense of mediums and sitters. Such a spook may even attach itself to anyone present, who is of low development, with deplorable results. Cases are known where some outside entity, either incarnate or excarnate, has seized upon the body of a sleeping man and used it, perhaps in sleepwalking, for his own ends. This would be most likely to happen with a person who is mediumistic. Chapter 21. The work of Dr. Walter J. Gilner, in the book called The Human Atmosphere, 1911, Dr. W. J. Kilner describes the investigations he has made on the human aura by means of colored screens. Dr. Kilner's main principles and discoveries are summarized in this chapter. For further details, especially of the manner of using the screens, the reader is referred to the book mentioned. It is interesting to note that Dr. Kilner expressly disclaims all clairvoyant power and did not even read accounts of the aura until over 60 of his patients had been examined. He claims that his methods are purely physical and can be employed with success by anyone who takes the necessary pains. The screens are thin, flat glass cells, containing diocyanin dyes in alcohol. Various colors are employed, for different purposes, such as dark and light carmine, blue, green and yellow. The operator looks through a dark screen at the light for half a minute or longer, and then at the patient through a pale screen, when he finds he is able to perceive the aura. Use of the screens appears to affect the eyes, at first temporarily and later permanently, so that after a time the operator is able to perceive the aura even without the screens. Great care, however, is advised in using the screens, as the eyes tend to become very painful. A dull diffused light, from one direction only, preferably from behind the observer, should be used, generally sufficient to enable the body to be seen distinctly. A dead black background is usually necessary, though for some observations a white one is required. The person being observed should be about 12 inches in front of the background, to avoid shadows and other optical illusions. In addition to the colored screens, Dr. Kilner has employed another ingenious method of investigating the aura, which he terms that of complementary colors. A band of color, 2 inches by 3/4 inch, fairly well illuminated, is looked at steadily for 30 to 60 seconds. This has the effect of fatiguing the powers of the eye to perceive that particular color, and in addition, the eyes are found to become abnormally sensitive to other colors. When then the gaze is transferred to the patient, a belt or band of complementary color is seen, the same size and shape as the original strip. This specter persists for some little time. In practice, it is found that color changes in the auras produce the effect of changing the appearance of the CC band. By this means, in skillful hands, A number of facts about the aura can be ascertained, which, by means of the screens alone, would remain undetected. The colors employed by Dr. Kilner are 1. Cambodge having a CC Prussian blue 2. Antwerp blue having a CC Cambodge 3. Carmen having a CC transparent emerald green 4. Emerald green having a CC Carmen. The aura is observed to consist of three distinct parts, called by Dr. Kilner colon 1. The etheric double 2. The inner aura 3. The outer aura. The etheric double appears through the screens as a dark band adjacent to and following exactly the contours of the body. Its width is uniform throughout and is usually from 1/16 th to 3/16 ths of an inch. It varies in size with different people, and also with the same person under altered conditions. It appears to be quite transparent and distinctly striated, with very delicate lines of a beautiful rose color, these appearing to tint the portions between the striations. The rose color certainly contains more blue than there is carmin. It seems probable that the lines are self-luminous. Up to the present, no attributes or changes in the etheric double have been found which are likely to be a help in diagnosis. The inner aura commences from the outer edge of the etheric double, though frequently it appears to touch the body itself. It is usually of a uniform width of 2 to 4 inches throughout, though sometimes slightly narrower down the limbs, and follows the contours of the body. It is relatively wider in children than in adults. Its structure is granular, the granules being exceedingly fine and so arranged as to appear striated. The striae are parallel to one another, being at right angles to the body, and in bundles, the longest in the center and the shortest on the outside, with a rounded margin. The bundles are massed together, thus creating a crenated outline of the aura. The striae have not been observed to possess any color. In LL they are less apparent. The inner aura is the densest portion of the aura proper. It is usually more distinctly marked and broader in persons in robust physical health. The outer aura commences from the outer edge of the inner aura and, unlike the inner aura, varies in size considerably. Round the head it extends usually about 2 inches beyond the shoulders, by the sides and back of the trunk it is about 4 or 5 inches wide, in front of the body it is a little narrower. It follows closely the contours of the body, being sometimes a little narrower down the lower limbs. Around the arms it corresponds to that encircling the legs, but is generally broader round the hands and frequently projects a long distance from the finger tips. The outline is not absolutely sharp, but gradually vanishes into space. The outer aura appears structureless and non-luminous. The inner portion of the outer aura has larger granules than the outer portions, the different sizes graduating imperceptibly into one another. The auras of boys and girls up to the age of about 12 or 13 appear similar, except that the texture of the female aura is usually finer than that of the male. From adolescence onwards the male and female auras become distinctive. In both, however, considerable peculiarities occur. The female aura is usually much wider at the sides of the body, the maximum width being at the waist, and it is also wider at the back than at the front, the widest part being at the small of the back, where frequently it bulges out. Dr. Kilner considers that a form approximating to an egg-shaped oval is the most perfect, deviations from this being due to underdevelopment. Fineness and transparency may be considered indications of a higher type of aura. Children have auras relatively broader in proportion to their height than adults. Children also, especially males, have an inner aura almost as wide as the outer, so that it may be difficult to differentiate the two. Persons of intelligence usually have larger auras than those of low intellect. This is especially marked round the head. The more graver is in the aura, the more dull or mentally affected is the owner. Sometimes an exceedingly faint haze can be seen extending outwards a very long distance beyond the outer aura. This has been observed only where the aura is unusually extensive, and it appears probable that it is a continuation of the outer aura. Dr. Kilner calls this the ultra outer aura. Bright patches, rays or streams have been observed, emanating from various parts of the body. Sometimes they appear and disappear rapidly, at other times they persist. Patches never seem to be colored. Rays are usually colorless, though occasionally tinted with different hues. Where they occur, the aura usually becomes denser. There are three varieties. First, rays or patches, lighter than the surrounding aura, entirely separated from but close to the body, appearing in and enveloped by the aura itself. In their most common form, they are elongated, their long axes parallel with the body. Their sides are usually distinct, exactly coincident with the edge of the inner aura, but the ends, usually contracted and less bright, often fade into the adjacent aura. The inner aura within the ray usually, but not always, loses its striated appearance, and becomes granular. The longer the ray persists, the coarser become the granules. Second, rays emanating from one part of the body and running to another part, not very distant. These rays are usually the most brilliant. They may be perceived running, for example, from the body to an arm, or, if the arm be bent, from the armpit to the wrist. If the observer holds his hand near the patient, the auras of both almost invariably become brighter locally, and in a short time a complete ray will be formed between the hand and the nearest part of the patient. Such rays are formed more easily between points than between surfaces. In one instance, a ray from the hand of one person to that of another was a bright yellow, changing to a liquid ruby color. Third, rays projecting at right angles from the body into space, brighter than and as far as, or even beyond, the outer aura. The sides of the rays are usually, though not always, parallel, and rarely fan-shaped. The ends become pointed and fade away, especially when issuing from the tips of the fingers. Rays have never been observed other than straight. Their normal direction is perpendicular to the body, but they may take any direction, as, for example, when flowing from the tips of the fingers of one person to those of another. In addition to the bluish-gray color, red and yellow have been observed to tinge rays. The facts that their structure resembles that of the inner aura, and that they have never been observed to diminish the adjacent outer aura, either in density or brightness, justify the conclusion that the rays and the inner aura have a common origin, the body, and that therefore a ray is merely an extended bundle of stri of the inner aura. Dr. Kilner has found also that, under similar conditions, though with more difficulty, he was able to perceive a haze or aura surrounding magnets, particularly the poles, having a bluish color, a yellow aura around a crystal of uranium nitrate, a bluish aura around the poles of galvanic cells, around any conductor joining the poles, and in the space between two wires connected each to one of the poles and to one another. From the facts, 1. That the inner aura has a striated structure, whilst the outer aura is entirely nebulous, 2. That the inner aura has a fairly well-marked border, that of the outer aura being ill-defined, 3. That the outer margin of the inner aura is crenated, but that of the outer aura does not in any way correspond, 4. That rays proceed from the inner aura but in no case have been observed to commence in the outer aura and pass through to the inner aura, Drive Kilner concludes, 1. That the outer aura is most probably derived from the inner, and, 2. That the two auras are most probably not the product of one and the same force. Dr. Kilner thus posits, 1. Number 1 auric force, for short 1F, which originates the inner aura, and, 2. Number 2 auric force, 2F, which originates the outer aura. 1F acts apparently very intensely within a prescribed area. Through local increase of force, rays may be projected consciously by an effort of will. 2F is more mobile and has a wider range of action than 1F. It appears to be entirely independent of the will. Different states of health, general or local, act on the forces, and through them on the auras, though not necessarily in the same manner on both inner and outer auras. A local affection may cause all the stri to disappear from the inner aura, the latter becoming more opaque and dense, and changing its color. It may also appear roughly rayed, in a manner quite different from the fine stri of health, or it may form a space devoid of the inner aura. An affection over a large portion of the body may make the inner aura narrower on one side of the body than on the other. This is accompanied by an alteration of texture in the inner aura and often also the color. Variations in the outer aura, consequent upon 2F, are less than is the case with the inner aura. The width may contract, but never quite disappear, and the color may change. A change over a large area of the body may completely alter the shape of the outer aura. The outer aura may become narrower, the inner aura being unaffected, but if the inner shrinks, the outer does also. Changes in the auras may be produced by disease. In hysteria, the outer aura is wider at the sides of the trunk, its width contracts suddenly near the pubes, a bulge occurs at the back in the lumbar region. In epilepsy, one side of both inner and outer auras for their whole length is usually contracted, the inner aura becomes opaque, the texture coarser, and striation diminishes or disappears. The color is usually gray. A contraction of the inner aura invariably implies a grave malady. Occasionally, an absolute break in the aura is observed. The inner aura does not alter in shape or size to any great extent, but it changes considerably in texture. The outer aura varies more frequently and more extensively in shape and size, but almost imperceptibly in texture. In case of disease, the earliest morbid symptom is diminution or complete loss of striation. Together with this, the granules become coarser, this being apparently due to amalgamation of smaller granules. Derangement of the inner aura is accompanied by a pari passu alteration of the outer aura. The preparation of the eye by means of the screens renders it difficult to appreciate accurately variations in the color of the aura. The color in the main appears to range from blue to gray, the color depending more on temperament and mental powers than on changes in bodily health. The greater the mental vigor, the bluer becomes the aura. Deficiency of mental power tends to grayness in the aura. Dr. Kilner carried out a few experiments which demonstrated not only that rays could be projected by an effort of will from various parts of the body, but also that the color of a ray or a part of the aura could be varied by an effort of will. Red, yellow and blue colors have been produced in this way. Blue was found to be the easiest to produce, and yellow the most difficult. A careful study of Dr. Kilner's results revealed that these agree with considerable accuracy with those obtained by clairvoyance. Dr. Kilner, however, appears to have studied more minutely, in some respects, the structure of the aura and the effects on it of disease. That which Dr. Kilner terms the etheric double is evidently identical with that which is described under the same name as clairvoyance. The striations of Dr. Kilner's in aurora are clearly the same as the health aura, see Chapter 4, p. 32. That which Dr. Kilner describes as the outer aura would appear to the present writer to consist of etheric particles from which the prana has been withdrawn and other etheric matter discharged from the body, see Chapter 11, Discharges. The student should compare the outlines of auras given in Dr. Kilner's book with Plate 24, of the health aura in man, visible and invisible. It would appear legitimate to surmise that further improvement of Dr. Kilner's methods would lead to the physical perception of 1. The etheric chakrams, 2. The flow of prana into and through the body, 3. The nature and structure of the etheric double within the body. Dr. Kilner, having referred to the difficulty of perceiving the aura against a background of flesh, the present writer has wondered whether a suitable background could not be obtained by coloring in some way the skin of the person being observed. Dr. Kilner states that his one objective in making his investigations has been to utilize the aura as a means of diagnosis. It is therefore more than probable that further investigations would reveal properties of the aura which, while perhaps having no diagnostic utility, would, nevertheless, be of scientific interest. From the observed facts, 1. That ill health deranges the aura, 2. That the etheric matter of adjacent auras flows together, forming rays, 3. That such rays can be formed and directed by an effort of the will, 4. That the will can determine even the color of such rays, it would appear but a very short step to the subject of magnetic or mesmeric healing. And it is to be hoped that some investigator will make a study of this important and interesting subject in the same painstaking manner that has characterized Dr. Kilner's own researches. Chapter 22: Etheric Faculties. Etheric faculties are extensions of the ordinary physical senses, enabling the possessor to appreciate vibrations pertaining to the etheric portion of the physical plane. Such impressions will be received through the retina of the eye, affecting of course its etheric matter. In some abnormal cases other parts of the etheric body may respond as readily as, or even more readily than, the eye. This would usually be due to partial astral development, the sensitive areas of the etheric double nearly always corresponding to the astral chakrams. There are roughly two main kinds of clairvoyance, the lower and the higher. The lower variety appears sporadically in undeveloped people, such as savages of Central Africa, and is a sort of massive sensation vaguely belonging to the whole etheric body, rather than an exact and definite sense perception communicated through a specialized organ. It is practically beyond the man's control. The etheric double being in exceedingly close relationship with the nervous system, any action on one of them reacts speedily on the other. In the lower clairvoyance, the corresponding nervous disturbance is almost entirely in the sympathetic system. In more developed races, the vague sensitiveness usually disappears as the mental faculties are developed. Later on, when the spiritual man begins to unfold, he regains clairvoyant power. This time, however, the faculty is precise and exact, under the control of the will, and exercised through a sense organ. Any nervous action set up is almost exclusively in the cerebrospinal system. The lower forms of psychism are most frequent in animals and very unintelligent human beings. Hysterical and ill-regulated psychism is due to the small development of the brain and the dominance of the sympathetic system, the large nucleated ganglionic cells in this system containing a very large proportion of etheric matter, and thus being easily affected by the coarser astral vibrations. Etheric vision may be temporarily stimulated, for example, by delirium tremens, so that the sufferer may see etheric, as well as astral, creatures. The snakes and other horrors seen in such cases are almost invariably creatures of low type which feast on alcoholic fumes exuding from the drunkard's body. It should be noted that the etheric double is peculiarly susceptible to the volatile constituents of alcohols. Clairvoyant faculty may also sometimes be exhibited under the influence of mesmerism, also by an increased tenseness of the nerves, caused by excitement, hysteria, ill health, drugs, or certain ceremonial rites which induce self-hypnotism. It is not, however, advisable to allow oneself to be thrown into mesmeric sleep in order to obtain clairvoyant experiences, because domination of their will by that of another person tends to make the will of the subject weaker and thus more liable to be acted upon by others. Occasionally, a person fortunate enough to have gained the friendship of etheric nature spirits may be helped by these creatures to attain flashes of temporary clairvoyance, in order that the person may see them. In order to cultivate such friendship, it must be remembered that these nature spirits are intensely shy and distrustful of men. They object to the physical emanations of the average man, of meat, tobacco, and alcohol, also to low selfish feelings, such as lust, anger, or depression. Strong, unselfish feelings of a lofty nature create the kind of atmosphere in which nature spirits delight to bathe. Almost all nature spirits are fond of music, and some are especially attracted by certain melodies. C.W. Leadbeater writes that he has seen shepherd boys in Sicily playing on their homemade panpipe, with an appreciative audience of fairies frisking around them, of which they were probably blissfully unconscious. Sometimes, however, peasants do see natural spirits, as the literature of many peoples affirms. One method of developing etheric sight is by utilizing the imagination. An endeavor is made to imagine what the inside of a physical object, such as a closed box, would be like, that is, to guess with an effort of strained attention, trying to see that which by ordinary sight could not be seen. After many attempts, it is said that the guessing becomes more frequently correct than the theory of probability would demand, and presently the man begins actually to see etherically that which at first he only imagined. It is said that this practice is followed by the Zuni tribe of American Red Indians, Sea Service Magazine, April, 1925, article by Beatrice Wood. Great numbers of people, if they will take the trouble to look, under suitable conditions of light, can see the mesmeric fluid, that is, the nerve ether, as it streams from the hands of the mesmerist. Baron Reichenbach, in the middle of the 19th century, records that he found over 60 persons able to see these emanations, and some could see also a somewhat similar emanation proceeding from physical magnets, from crystals, and from a copper wire, one end of which was exposed to sunlight. The observers were usually shut up in a dark room for some hours in order to make the retina more sensitive. It is reported that some French scientists, who could not normally see the N rays, became able to do so after sitting in darkness for 3 or 4 hours.